If ever a man was ahead of his time, it was H.G. Wells. Obsessed with the future, he dreamed up a machine that could take him there. His ideas were shockingly advanced, especially about sex. Ideas he attempted to live out in two marriages and countless affairs. His ideas were also highly prophetic, especially his ideas about the crisis looming over the future of man.
Today, man is successfully probing deep into the mysteries of the universe. Can he penetrate the greatest mystery of all, time itself?
H.G. Wells will always be known as the author of The Time Machine, The War of the Worlds, and other disturbing fantasies that laid the foundation of modern science fiction. Writing at the end of the 19th century, he was among the first to see and understand the shadow of disaster hanging over the 20th century. The very new and very real possibility of complete destruction for the Earth and mankind. He was a spectacular dominating figure for more than 40 years, one of the most famous and charismatic writers of his time, an acclaimed novelist, historian, futurist, social critic, and pioneering champion of sexual freedom and women's rights. But most of all, H.G. Wells was a prophet torn between a 20th century vision of catastrophe. He forecast the atom bomb and both world wars, and a belief in the utopian evolutionary promise of man.
Which shall it be?
Herbert George Wells began his travel through time on September 21st, 1866. He was born in Bromley, Kent, a small town outside of London, and he was born into Victorian England, a society in which his place was fixed, at the lower end. Wells' parents belonged to the downstairs world of Victorian society. His mother, Sarah, had been a lady's maid, his father, Joseph, a gardener. The couple put their life savings into a china shop called Atlas House. But business was never good, and young Wells grew up in the basement of the store. A dismal, unsanitary hole is how he would remember it. He spent hours looking up through a grating at the people walking by, a boots-eye view of the world that he never forgot. When he was 7, Wells broke his leg.
The normal therapy of that time was to put it in a cast and then lie for months, sometimes 3 months, before you came out of the cast. Wells, all he could do was lie and read books, but reading those books opened up an immense world for him. He called it several times himself a turning point, my lucky moment.
Surrounded by books, Wells' imagination soared. By the time he was 10, he was writing and illustrating his own full-length novels. The Desert Daisy is the only one to survive.
The Desert Daisy is an example of Wells at his masterful best as a child, I think. It is a strip cartoon, but it's also a novel. To do it at 10 years old is absolutely incredible. And the pictures still stand up, and the text is actually worth reading.
Now, this book is amazing. It has a title page, an editor's preface, and preface to the first edition. Dear reader, you have in your hands The Desert Daisy. A romance of the olden time. I am not at all vain, but still I think that if this book is not read when Shakespeare is forgotten, it will have been grievously ill-treated.
Despite his talent, Wells' prospects were bleak. With Atlas House nearly bankrupt, Sarah Wells was forced to return to work as a servant. H.G., just 13, was taken out of school and sent to the London firm of Rogers and Denyer to become a draper's apprentice.
Now it was my turn to put the books away, give up drawing and painting and every sort of free delight, stop writing stories, and serve an employer. I hated this place from the outset.
The life of an apprentice in late Victorian England was not only dark and gloomy, the hours were long. They started oftentimes at 7 in the morning, went till 8 at night.
He wasn't good at it at all. And he was criticized because he would spend time reading books when he should have been working on the job and he couldn't keep accounts properly and the most unsatisfactory employee.
Not surprisingly, Rogers and Denyer dismissed young Bert Wells after 3 months. But instead of going home to Bromley, he joined his mother, who was now chief housekeeper at a country estate called Up Park. While Sarah tried to figure out what to do with him, 13-year-old Wells had the run of the place, including the mansion library, and it changed his life. He devoured books by Swift and Defoe, whose travel fantasies made a lasting impression. And he discovered Plato's Republic, a book that spurred Wells to look critically at his own world.
That was, for me, a very releasing book indeed for my mind. Here was the amazing and heartening suggestion that the whole fabric of law, custom, and worship, which seemed so invincibly established, might be cast into the melting pot and made anew.
At Up Park, Wells made another discovery, a telescope. He sat spellbound night after night, examining the craters of the moon. More than anything, however, Up Park gave Wells a glimpse of another world, the upstairs world of 19th century England.
I think that H.G. Wells was influenced by his stay at Up Park to realize that his horizons could be greater than they were. He's still oppressed there. That is, he's still part of the downstairs world. But he sees the upstairs world and realizes that it's there. He can get to it.
But it won't be easy. After 4 months, Sarah Wells again apprenticed young H.G. to be a draper, this time at the South Sea Drapery Emporium in South Sea.
Almost as unquestioning as her belief in our father was her belief in drapers. She thought that to wear a black coat and tie behind a counter was the best of all possible lots attainable by man. At any rate, by men at our social level.
Barely 14, Wells was now working the job that he was expected to keep for the rest of his life. A job that took no account whatsoever of his talents and dreams.
Get on with it, Wells.
Wells forward.
Has anyone seen Wells?
Sign.
But you haven't shown the
at
Lady
the
Kingham
at 6-3. At the back of my mind, growing larger and more vivid, until it was like the word of the Lord coming to one of his prophets, was the injunction, get out of this trade before it is too late. At any cost, get out of it.
By the time he was 15, he knew that he could not stand it any longer. So he walked from South Sea to Up Park, about 30 miles, and said to his mother, I can't do it anymore, and I'm going to kill myself. I'm gone. You must get me out of this. She couldn't believe it. Being a draper was a wonderful thing, and Wells reiterated his threat to commit suicide. She then knew the threat was real.
With Sarah's reluctant consent, Wells found a job as a teacher's helper in the small town of Midhurst. At the Midhurst Grammar School, he taught full-time, but spent every spare moment studying, inhaling subject after subject, driven by a sense that this was his chance not only to learn, but to escape the draper's life. In a kind of learning frenzy, Wells squeezed an entire education into 2 years.
I don't think he slept. I don't see how he could have slept. Wells won virtually every prize that was offered in those 2 years. And they were on every subject. They were on chemistry, on physics, on astronomy, on geology, on botany. Anything you name, he took the test, he won the prize, and pocketed the money.
Wells capped it off by winning a university scholarship to study in London. What had seemed like an impossible dream had become reality. Wells had broken through the rigid boundaries of Victorian society. He would neither be a servant nor a draper. He was going to be a university student and a man of science. By the time he was 18, H.G. Wells had come a long way from the downstairs world of his servant parents to the heady possibilities of science and university life.
The day I walked across Kensington Gardens to the Normal School of Science and went to the biological laboratory, was one of the great days of my life. I had come from beginnings of an elementary sort to the fountainhead of knowledge.
Wells' years in college were the most stimulating and important of his intellectual life. His teacher, Thomas Huxley, was one of the great lights of British science and a fearless defender of Charles Darwin.
We know of Huxley today because he was the man who told us what Darwin meant. It was called Darwin's bulldog, in fact, because he constantly defended him everywhere. And Wells found sitting in the classroom, watching him dissect a rabbit, listening to him talk about science, and listening to him talk especially about the impact of Darwin, that our species was a product of a long series of evolution, that we were just a species in the long history of the world.
Darwin's theory of evolution had a profound impact on young Wells. He was fascinated by the questions it raised about the animal species known as man, the evolutionary possibility of extinction, or creative adaptation and survival. The future especially intrigued Wells. His first published work, appearing in 1887 in a college journal he helped found, was called A Tale of the 20th Century. Once again, 10 years after Wells had written The Desert Daisy and other boyish novels, writing caught his imagination and stirred his dreams. Wells fantasized writing books, grandiose books that would solve the problems of the world, a dream he illustrated in a letter to a friend. After college, he found work in London as a journalist, exploiting his science background to explain the new discoveries and inventions that were transforming the city. He worked hard, holding down 2 teaching jobs and writing full-time. By 1891, Wells was supporting his mother, who had been dismissed from Uppark, and his father, unemployed since the china shop went under. Little Bertie riding away for dear life to get little things for all his little people, he wrote, in an illustrated note to his parents. And Wells had someone else to support as well, his cousin Isabel, whom he had met and fallen in love with while still a student. After a 7-year wait, they married in 1891. The marriage was a bitter disappointment, foundering immediately on that most Victorian of battlegrounds, sex. Wells, the rebel, was full of unashamed sexual feeling. Isabel was not.
My imagination had exaggerated the joy of embracing a woman until it became maddeningly desirable. Isabel was my primary fixation. All the cloudy drift of my desire centered on her. But for Isabel, lovemaking was nothing more than an outrage inflicted upon reluctant womankind.
The relationship is strong to begin with, but Isabel then takes on the Victorian role that he was fighting against. She's acting now like a Victorian China doll. He isn't going to take on those Victorian moralities. In fact, he's already said they're gone. He doesn't want that world. In fact, he's going to do all he can to destroy it.
Overworked and overwrought, Wells began coughing up blood and had a physical breakdown in 1893. Diagnosed with TB, he spent weeks in bed. He entertained himself by writing and illustrating letters, many of them to a pretty science student named Amy Catherine Robbins. Like Wells, Miss Robbins was in full revolt against Victorian society, and the two were drawn to each other as allies in their fight against a narrow life. In December 1893, 2 years after he had married Isabel, Wells left his wife to live with Amy Catherine. Unmarried, they lived as man and wife, taking on Victorian society as well as their own scandalized families. Robbins' brothers visited Wells and threatened to beat him up if he didn't marry their sister.
My grandmother ran away with my grandfather. And, you know, this in itself was an extraordinary sort of liberated thing to do, particularly because he had a wife at the time.
They were breaking all the moral codes there were. And as soon as the first landlady knew it, she threw him out into the street. You couldn't do that. It just wasn't done. Wells actually says in some correspondence, I probably have killed all of the chance of success, but I have to do it anyway.
In fact, success was just around the corner. Wells' first book, a textbook of biology, was published in 1893. H.G. inscribed it to Amy Catherine with a drawing of a rabbit dissecting a man. Buoyed by his success, Wells decided to take a daring chance. He put aside his journalism to work on something he called his peculiar treasure, a book about a machine that no one had ever imagined before, a machine that could travel through time. "It's my trump card," Wells wrote. "If it does not come off very much, I shall know my place for the rest of my career." By 1895, H.G. Wells had been working on a novel about time travel for 7 years. A first draft, called The Chronic Argonauts, appeared in the Science School's journal in 1888. 6 drafts later, now calling it The Time Traveler, he found a publisher. "Please type in your best style," Wells, in a buoyant mood, wrote on top of the manuscript. The Time Machine, as it was finally called, was an enormous success. Wells received only £100 for the book, but his reputation was made. The novel was unlike anything that had been written to that time, a blend of speculative science and intense imagination, a science romance, as Wells called it.
"I am afraid I cannot convey the peculiar sensations of time traveling. I saw trees growing and changing like puffs of vapor, now brown, now green. They grew, spread, shivered, and passed away. I saw huge buildings rise up, faint and fair, and pass like dreams. The whole surface of the earth seemed changed, melting, and flowing under my eyes."
I don't think anybody called it science fiction in those days. He practically invented the genre. I mean, there were people like Jules Verne and so on. But I think H.G.'s big advantage was that he was actually a serious scientist who could extrapolate from what he'd got.
Jules Verne had also written about science in the future, but Wells' fantasies were more provocative and disturbing. In The Time Machine, Wells took the dry theory of Darwin, which had only been considered in relation to man's past, and applied it to his distant future. The time traveler doesn't just go 100 or 200 years ahead in time. He goes 802,000 years ahead, far enough to find out the end of the evolutionary drama. And then he goes 30 million years further and offers a vision of a dying planet.
At the end of The Time Machine, you go to Entropy Beach, if you will, where all we see is a red sun and a few crab-like creatures flopping around, and this is the end of history. And yet, the time traveler comes back. The focus of that novel is really the present. And there is a sense that, you know, even though we know the end, we can still go on and face it, and maybe we can beat it.
Wells followed The Time Machine with a dazzling creative spree, writing a series of books over the next 5 years that established the archetypes of modern science fiction: The War of the Worlds, The Island of Dr. Moreau, The Invisible Man, The First Men on the Moon.
The major scenarios of science fiction were really invented by Wells. The Time Machine, time travel, War of the Worlds, alien encounter, The Island of Dr. Moreau, an extension of the scientist theme. I really don't know any other writer, be it Cervantes or Shakespeare. They all worked according to models that were well known in their culture, but Wells invented models. It's an astounding feat of the mind.
And of the will. Wells worked feverishly during these years. He depicted himself in one of his drawings as the head of a kind of writing factory, dropping pages down to Amy Catherine, to the editors, to the critics. Helping him through it all, Amy Catherine. They were very close and worked as a team, cycling through London and the surrounding countryside together, marking locations for the Martians to destroy in War of the Worlds. She became his most trusted critic, and Wells awaited her verdict on everything he wrote. They married after Wells divorced Isabel in 1895. And they collaborated, as Wells put it, in the invention of a human being, Their son, George, born in 1901. Another son, Frank, was born in 1903. By that time, Wells was prosperous enough to build a home, and his mother, who was sick, moved in with him. Despite H.G.'s success, she was never quite convinced that he hadn't made a big mistake by spurning the respectable life of a drapery clerk.
There's a marvelous story that he went back to his mother and said, look, you know, I've made 50 quid writing. She said, oh, but Bertie, I do wish you'd taken a regular trade. And it wasn't until he started accumulating serious money and building a house and things like that that she really finally gave up.
In the time machine, Wells had looked into the future and caught a vision of a dying world. In 1900, he turned to the other side of the Darwinian equation, to the evolutionary changes man would have to make in order to survive. In a series of highly influential prophetic books, Wells described and crusaded for the necessary new world. His core idea was that technology had created a single world, that war from now on would be global, with the potential for global destruction, and that peace and the planet could therefore only be ensured by the evolution of a world society, an enlightened world state.
Wells invented the term world state. People didn't know what the term meant. He projected it, talked about it. Today we think about it all the time, but it's because he put it there with his writings.
Wells continued to write fiction, but he put aside his science fantasies in favor of autobiographical novels about the downstairs world from which he had escaped. Forgotten today, books like Kipps and Love and Mr. Lewisham were as famous as The Time Machine, and Wells was hailed as a second Dickens.
He was thought of as the voice of modern British fiction. His writing was more widely read than any other single individual in his time.
Wells was also writing groundbreaking novels about sexual freedom and women's rights. In books like The Passionate Friends and Anne Veronica, he drew shocking portraits of women who rejected marriage and refused to hide their own sexuality, portraits that helped create a generation of feminists.
In Anne Veronica, to read about a young woman at 18 saying, to hell with her father, and going off to live in London with an older man and then eventually junking him too. I mean, come on. In Wells's own time, it was his achievement in this area that was as important as the science fiction before. The women of his time, all the rest of their lives, talked about what reading H.G. Wells had done for them.
But Wells was at his most daring and radical when it came to sex. His essays and novels on the subject would have raised eyebrows in the 1960s, attacking the patriarchal family, advocating birth control, describing sex of the future as a form of refreshment for men and women both.
Wells was interested in threesomes and foursomes and whatever it would be. He simply said that the institution of marriage and the institution of all the various sacraments were bunk. I mean, he just simply said, let's throw these things out. Let's go directly to love. Love is an impulse. It's an attraction between two human beings.
Most shocking of all, Wells was living out his ideas. His marriage with Amy Catherine was successful in every area but sex. Like his first wife, Isabel, Amy Catherine was sexually distant, especially after two painful childbirths. To save the marriage, they agreed on what Wells described as a modus vivendi.
The agreement was that he, in fact, could have other relationships with other women. He could have his passades, but he had to come home to her. He had to come home and spend the weekends with her. He had to be Jane's Bertie, as it were, when he came home.
Jane really tended to say, look, not sure that I'm really as enthusiastic about this sex thing as you are, but if you must do it, I'm not going to stand in your way, provided you don't do it underhand and you let me know what's going on. I think she was a very modern woman.
In his memoirs, Wells described himself as a Don Juan among the intellectuals. He had innumerable affairs. Novelist Rebecca West, writer Violet Hunt, Countess Elizabeth Van Arnim, birth control activist Margaret Sanger, novelist Dorothy Richardson, and a young student, the daughter of a prominent socialist, Amber Reeves.
Well, at first blush, when you look at H.G. Wells and Amber Reeves, you think, my God, he's nearly 50 and she's 19. This doesn't make much sense at all. Except Amber Reeves is the new woman. If he had been Pygmalion constructing her, Amber Reeves would have been the person he constructed. She was there for him because she was what he was writing about.
Acting like a heroine from one of Wells' novels, Reeves declared her love for him in a field, and the two proceeded to enjoy what Wells described as days of insatiable mutual appreciation. When she became pregnant, the scandal was enormous, but Wells refused to end the affair or even hide it. Every week they would walk together, she visibly pregnant, through Hyde Park. Amy Catherine knew everything, was on good terms with Amber, and bought clothes for the baby. Eventually, Amber married an old friend, a kind of cover-up husband, and Wells continued to see her until 1912. I'm afraid I behaved rather scandalous, but know how mean, he wrote a friend. Believe everything scandalous and nothing mean. Since The Time Machine, H.G. Wells had warned of an evolutionary crisis facing mankind. The crisis came in 1914 in the form of the First World War. Wells himself had predicted the means of modern warfare, more or less inventing the tank in a 1903 novel called Ironclads, and forecasting the military use of planes in his book, The War in the Air. Despite his socialist writings and utopian visions, Wells threw himself into the British war effort. This was the war that would end war, he predicted. Britain and the Allies, horrified by the destruction, would surely use their victory to build a world state. In fact, it was Wells who was horrified and quickly disillusioned. As the war dragged on, his hair began falling out in patches, and he concluded bitterly that all the nations, including his own, were fighting for their own advantage, that nations themselves had become obsolete and a deadly danger to man.
The whole intellectual life of man revolts against this intolerable, suffocating, murderous nuisance, the national state.
The war convinced Wells, more than ever, of the evolutionary need for some kind of world government.
World War I had an extraordinary impact on H.G. Wells because Wells realized that he had to become the public missionary toward the world state. No one else was going to do it. No government was going to do it. And he said, I am going to take this chance.
In writings and speeches, Wells campaigned for a League of Free Nations, a kind of United States of the world, with enough real power to take war out of the hands of individual states. He was bitterly critical of the actual League of Nations, formed in 1920, which had no such power, and which he dismissed as a piece of stage scenery. Wells decided to attack nationalism on a new front, education. He began writing a book that might help create a world consciousness, a book so daring in scope that no one had ever tried to write one like it before, a history of the entire world.
Well, it was the outline of history, of the whole of history, a story of what really had happened in the world, all the different civilizations. He did it with a sense of duty to begin with, not in order to make money, but because it ought to be done. In fact, it was an enormous success, and he did make a lot of money out of it.
Incredibly, Wells researched and wrote his 1,000-page outline of history in a single year. A year of fanatical toil. It was published in 24 installments, and its impact was enormous.
In The Outline of History, which, by the way, is the second best-selling book in the 20th century, H.G. Wells put the history of the world into 1,000 pages, and it's a page-turner. It's the first time history really had a meaning for ordinary people.
Outline of History sold 2 million copies in England and America in its first year. It made Wells so rich, he began to live like minor royalty, in the words of one acquaintance. He was now more famous and influential than ever, 30 years after The Time Machine, and for a completely different kind of writing, Wells was at the peak of his influence and fame.
Author H.G. Wells in 1923, probably doing first draft of another best-selling novel. Famed for his brilliant outline of history, Wells made history with his amazing pen.
As his fame grew, so did his notoriety as a womanizer. Women continued to revere Wells and throw themselves at his feet. One admirer came to his house wearing nothing but high heels and a raincoat and slashed her wrists when he tried to put her out. Another woman, Odette Kuhn, was more successful. An exotic-looking adventuress from Constantinople, she wrote passionate letters to Wells, offering herself to him. "We had an adoration for him," she would later write. "He was a superstar." They became lovers, and Wells built a home for her in the south of France. She named it Lou Padou, her nickname for H.G., Little God. As he had done since his affair with Amber Reeves, Wells led a kind of double life, dividing his time between Odette and Amy Catherine, still living out the extraordinary terms of their open marriage. Amy Catherine knew all about Odette and H.G., and even bought housewarming gifts for their home in France.
She got rather a rough deal from H.G.'s philandering around the place. In fact, I think all the evidence is that she didn't terribly mind. They were a surprisingly close-knit couple, although H.G. from time to time took up with other people.
Wells was with Odette on May 10, 1927, when he got a telegram informing him that Jane had cancer. Her death, 5 months later, was devastating. Despite H.G.'s infidelities, their bond had been very strong, going back all the way to the years before The Time Machine, when Amy, or Jane, as he preferred to call her, was the other woman, and their romance was a scandal.
When Jane died, I believe H.G. Wells came to the realization, for the first time perhaps, what she really had meant to him. She had been the first woman to love him back in an equal kind of way. The rest of his life, working toward the Wells state, is a life which doesn't have the personal, intense quality that his life before. Jane's death was profoundly important and difficult for him to deal with.
After the death of his wife, Amy Catherine, H.G. Wells began to suffer from serious, at times, suicidal depression. His affair with Odette Kuhn had wound down. He was suffering from diabetes, and he was dogged by a sense of failure and wasted effort. The menace of nationalism was worse than ever, especially in Italy and Germany, where fascism was on the rise. When Hitler came to power in 1933, Wells' books were among the first to be burned. One book the Nazis tossed into the bonfire was The Shape of Things to Come, a fiercely futuristic novel that was made into a movie in 1936. Wells' book was eerily prophetic, depicting a world war that began in 1940 with the German invasion of Poland. Wells also forecast the Blitz of London, which he presented so realistically that it served as a kind of national rehearsal for the real thing.
When you look at it, you think you're looking at World War II scenes. You think you're looking at the Blitz in London. You forget that it's a movie set. He has an uncanny understanding of how people would react. It's a remarkable piece of prophecy.
Things to Come also brought to life Wells' vision of a futuristic world state run by an enlightened elite and strewn with spectacular technology. Just months after the movie premiere, Wells celebrated his 70th birthday. By now the grand old man of English letters, he was feted at a gala party surrounded by friends, family, former lovers, and literary colleagues. Wells couldn't quite accept the fact that he was 70 years old, that his travel through time was winding down.
I feel like a little boy at a lovely party who has been given quite a lot of jolly toys and who has spread his play about the floor. Then comes his nurse. "Now, Master Bertie," she says, "it's getting late. Time you began putting away your toys." But I don't want to go. I hate being 70. Few of my games are nearly finished, and some, I feel, have hardly begun.
We interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin.
At least 40 people lie dead. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country.
On October 30th, 1938, rioting broke out across the eastern United States when Orson Welles broadcast a radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. The Halloween radio cast announced, in news bulletin style, that Martians had landed in New Jersey and were killing people with a heat ray. H.G. Wells was amused, though not surprised, by the spectacle.
Orson Welles' radio program produced a furor and a panic in the United States that Welles thought was deliciously ironic because it was exactly what he had predicted when he wrote The War of the Worlds. He described a complete public panic. And of course, that happened in the United States on the next day.
At a radio station in Texas the following year, H.G. met Orson Welles. They discussed War of the Worlds and the coming World War.
"You aren't quite serious in America yet, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror."
"Mr. Welles' future is suddenly upon us,
mm-hmm.
and we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future."
When Welles returned to London, World War II had already broken out. He stayed in London throughout the war, in an apartment next to Regent Park, and insisted on taking his turn patrolling for fires during the Blitz.
He was fairly bloody-minded. He didn't see any reason why he was going to be pushed out of London by Adolf Hitler. So he lived in Regent's Park in the middle of London, and from time to time the bombs blew his windows out.
"My mother told me the carpenter kept having to come to mend the front door, which was a great big one. A lot of the V2s, I think, landed on the Regent's Park, which was just opposite, and the door kept blowing in."
H.G. Wells remained in London during the Blitz and during the V-bombs because he thought it was the way a British person ought to act under stress. And he was well aware of the rich and the wealthy going to their country homes, and he wanted to call attention to that.
Living in the epicenter of a world war he'd been warning against for a lifetime, Wells continued to sound the hopeful note.
"America, Russia, and the British system, if they took possession of the air, as they are quite capable of doing, nothing could withstand them. They could take the air out of politics, out of international affairs, and lay the foundations for a world peace that would endure forever."
His last crusade was for a Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man, a document that he wrote and that eventually became a cornerstone of the United Nations.
"All my books, from The Time Machine on, insist on the insecurity of progress, the possibility of human degeneration and extinction. I think the odds are against man, but it is still worth fighting for."
That was the courage of H.G. Wells. He saw all of these things very clearly. In fact, as a writer, depicted them probably in the most austere and stark fashion imaginable. But then he went on to believe in human reason, which is incredible.
Privately, Wells was not holding up so well. He was tormented by a bitter sense that he had failed and that the world had failed. Finding him alone in a corner at a party,
A friend asked Wells what he was doing. "Writing my epitaph," he replied. "God damn you all. I told you so."
I think he got a bit depressed in his last few years because, you know, all those idealisms about spread of socialism went sour. And people getting better educated and being more sensible as a result, that went sour. The whole belief that the League of Nations was a fine, hopeful thing, that went down the drain. Many of the things that he actually had faith in had gone bad on him.
With the revelations of Auschwitz and the bombing of Hiroshima, Wells drifted towards despair.
The opening up of the concentration camps and the total inhumanity of our species to others, these were the worst culminating events for H.G. Wells, because he thought that we hadn't learned anything.
Wells himself had predicted the atom bomb, describing it in remarkable detail in 1914 in a novel called The World Set Free. The book actually played a small role in the development of the bomb, convincing Leo Szilard, a key member of the nuclear team, that splitting the atom was possible. For Wells, the use of the A-bomb seemed to answer the question that had haunted him since the time machine, the evolutionary question about the destiny of man. After Hiroshima, he painted a mural behind his apartment, showing the forms of life from dinosaurs to humans. Under the figure of man, Wells wrote, "Time to go."
With the period to be estimated by weeks and months rather than by eons, there has been a fundamental change in the conditions under which life exists. The end of everything we call life is close at hand and cannot be evaded. It is going clean out of existence, leaving not a wreck behind.
Still, like the hero in the time machine, Wells behaved as if it were not so. Dying of liver cancer, he went outdoors for the last time on August 13, 1946, to vote. He died 3 weeks later at the age of 79. The memorial service reflected his life.
Virtually everyone who had been part of his life was there. Legitimate children, illegitimate children, grandchildren, old girlfriends. Rebecca was there. He was gone, but as one of them said, "Now we'll give him to the ages."
After the service, Wells' oldest son, Jip, and Anthony West, his son from his affair with novelist Rebecca West, tossed his ashes into the sea. H.G. Wells' amazing travel through time was over.
"I am English by origin, but I am early world man, and I live in exile from the world community of my desires. I salute that finer, larger world across the generations, and maybe someone down the vista may look back and appreciate an ancestral salutation."